loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening. It's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. As Donald Trump doubles down on his anti-China rhetoric following President Obama's so-called pivot to Asia, could a coming escalation between the United States and China actually lead to a war? We'll speak with prolific filmmaker John Pilger about his new documentary, The Coming War on China. The Syrian army advances in Aleppo with the vast majority of the city now under its control. Opposition forces in the city all but acknowledge defeat as they propose a 5-day ceasefire. Will they ever recover? Fidel Castro was buried over the weekend, but his legacy continues to live on in the Cuban Revolution. We will look at how the revolution brought about tremendous progress for Cuba's black population and the country's contribution to Africa's liberation struggles. But first we turn to John Pilger, filmmaker, and his latest film, The Coming War on China. Welcome back, John Pilger.
Thank you. Good to be back.
Thanks for joining. Tell us about your new documentary, which is your 60th film. What made you want to make this movie? What's the general idea? Is it that a war between the United States and China is coming, that it's imminent, that it's in the distant future? Talk about your project.
Well, this is the end of 2 years of filmmaking and research on this film. I want to make it because I've spent a lot of time as a journalist and filmmaker in the Asia Pacific and also in the United States. I mean, really to understand how the world is ordered, you have to understand the whole rapacious sense in Washington, and especially a Washington in which the Pentagon is ascendant. My interest was really heightened in 2009 when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, and she went to the Philippines. The Philippines, which in the 1990s had effectively kicked out two of the biggest U.S. bases in Asia at Subic Bay and Clark, and popular movements in the Philippines achieved that. It was a very unusual thing to happen. And Hillary Clinton arrived in 2009 to try and get those bases back. If not those bases, then to bring back a very significant U.S. military presence. And she achieved that with, I suspect, bribes of arms and money to the Aquino regime in Manila. Five bases, rotating bases, were established in the Philippines, in the South China Sea, really just across from the Spratly Islands. And in the Spratly Islands at the time, the Chinese were beginning to eye the possibility of building defenses against not only those bases in the Philippines, but some 400 other bases that ring China all the way from Asia up through the Pacific, as I say, through the Philippines, up through Korea and Japan, across Eurasia. But the significance of this Clinton trip was not simply persuading or demanding that the Filipinos have U.S. bases back, but internationalizing the Spratly Islands. There has been a long-running dispute over the Spratly Islands and the Paracel Islands in the South China Sea. There are many of these islets and reefs and rocks all the way up to the Japanese and the Chinese have a not dissimilar dispute going on. But there was, at the time she arrived, serious negotiations between China and the Philippines about resolving that. She put an end to that and said that the South China Sea was now a national security issue for the United States. And from that point on, propaganda campaign got underway against China. 2 years later, in Australia, President Obama stood up in the Australian Parliament and announced the pivot to Asia, the transfer of two-thirds of all U.S. air and sea and naval forces to the Asia-Pacific, the biggest, in effect, the biggest build-up of military forces since the Second World War. And, of course, the target here was China. So this has been developing now for 6-7 years, and I have followed it, and it's now a very serious matter. China, the fact that China is encircled, almost in a kind of great strategic noose of all these bases that, you know, some of them are extraordinary. Okinawa is just almost one big U.S. base and only about 500 miles from China. A new base has been built on Jeju Island, Korea, purpose-built for the Aegis missile destroyers, which are aimed at China's defenses. And in Korea mainland itself, the THAAD missile system is being installed, ostensibly aimed at North Korea, but aimed at China. So this build-up has been happening, and of course getting very little news attention. What news attention there has been around China building airstrips in the Spratly Islands, but undoubtedly as a defensive measure and in response to this huge strategic encirclement, if you like, from the United States. So this is something we needed to know about, and my film really is a warning. It's not saying that China and the U.S. are about to go to war, but it is saying that there is a great landscape of potential mistakes and accidents. The U.S. Navy is provocatively sailing missile destroyers straight through the Spratly Islands in order to provoke China. Chinese fighter planes have scrambled in response. There are many of these incidents, so-called, that are happening that don't themselves suggest that war is about to break out, but there is a great risk here. There is most certainly a recklessness, but there is a risk.
We're talking with John Pilger. He's a prolific filmmaker and author. He's made 60 documentaries and 60 movies, many documentaries. He's just released his latest documentary called The Coming War on China. John Pilger, of course, Donald Trump's call with the Taiwanese president, what made big news, it made big news because it was a break of protocol. Ever since the United States dropped any recognition for the so-called Republic of China, which is the entity that rules over Taiwan, and that's been true since 1979, the U.S. has adopted a one-China policy, which, of course, doesn't stop, as Trump said, the United States from selling billions and billions of dollars of arms regularly to Taiwan, but there's been this protocol in place. But your comments and your point, I think, is so important because while Trump is noted as a reckless figure, perhaps, or trying to upset the international status quo or apple cart, that apple cart has really been upset with the Asia pivot. And even before the announced Asia pivot, which President Obama did in Australia a few years ago, as you said, by Hillary Clinton's intervention in the Philippines in 2009 with the Enhanced Defense Cooperation Act, which is still in place and allowing the United States against the will, as you said, of the Filipino people to come back. When we look at the Asia pivot, we have by 2020, the plans are to have 60% of the U.S. naval assets and Air Force assets in the Asia Pacific region. At the same time, it was the Obama administration and the Clinton State Department that encouraged the old Filipino government, the Aquino government, to go to The Hague to try to seek arbitration against China's sovereign claims in the South China Sea, something China said absolutely no entity in The Hague is going to determine where we have sovereignty, of course. Now we have Rodrigo Duterte, the new president of the Philippines, saying, I'm not going to be America's puppet. And he went to China and announced at least that the Philippine relationship was going to be significantly altered, and that he said the U.S. troops should get out of Mindanao, the biggest southernmost island in the Philippines. I mean, the whole part of what we're witnessing, it's not just about Trump. There is this sort of toxic, malignant mix-up that's happening as a consequence of a dramatic reorientation of U.S. policy towards China.
Well, yes, Duterte certainly has caused Washington to be nervous. Whether or not his deeds match his words, we have yet to see. He's an interesting maverick. He comes from the South. He has a great sense of his country as a colony, American colony, that was brutalized for such a long time, a history that has often been suppressed, certainly in the United States, but not in the historical memory and consciousness in the Philippines. And he has certainly played to that. He has said all the things and done all the things that you've described, but those bases are still there, and the Philippines are still taking part in military exercises with the U.S. So whether he will go as far as his very interesting rhetoric and his background suggests, we don't know yet. But you mentioned Trump. Now, that's interesting. I mean, the problem with the idea of Trump, let alone Trump the man, is that everything can be blamed on Trump, you know, like everything was blamed on or is blamed on Putin. Back in the Cold War, everything is to be blamed on Mao. The demon is a great Western invention. Once we have a couple of demons, we can really blame everything on them, including the weather and climate change, everything. Now, Trump attracts that kind of attention. And as you mentioned, he attracted it especially over the last week when, first of all, he very deliberately communicated with the president of Taiwan and upset China. The Chinese will be very aware that Trump's new chief of staff has close relations with the Taiwanese government. This is not to say that a Trump administration is about to turn the clock back and push the most populous nation on earth, if that was possible, into the shadows. That's not going to happen. But it's a very provocative and very risky game that he's playing. Undoubtedly, he's doing it to try and backfoot the Chinese because he wants a new trade deal with them. He said some rhetorically extreme things, like the Chinese are responsible for the greatest robbery in history and they've raped our economy and all that, as if the Chinese are responsible for American multinationals going to China, such as Apple and the rest. So he's crying foul in a game that was really invented by the United States, before that by Britain and other imperial powers. And this is not to say the Chinese haven't done well out of it. They have. But it was the United States, as it is Britain and other Western developed advanced countries, that decided to give up, in effect, their manufacturing base and become monetarist states. That is the very core of so-called neoliberalism. Now, Trump is going to try and tamper with that. But first of all, he has to try and unnerve the Chinese. The problem with unnerving the Chinese is they've been pretty well unnerved over the last few years. A whole brace of admirals and generals have been let loose on the world stage to go and shoot their mouths off about China building the Great Wall of Sand across the South China Sea and all of that. They've been unnerved by the fact that the biggest military exercise in modern memory, Operation Talisman, was conducted last year with the explicit purpose of rehearsing a blockade of China, a blockade through the Malacca Straits, the Lombok Straits, and ultimately through the South China Sea, through which pass 80% of China's oil, it's much of its trade and raw materials. So China is already unnerved. So it's a very risky game that that Trump is playing.
Yeah. John Pilger, let me ask you in our last minute, we have, as you said, really a bipartisan or nonpartisan attack or growing confrontation, at least rhetorically, but more than rhetorically, with lots of military moves against China over the past years, not just the past couple of weeks. But Donald Trump supporters were instrumental in adding a paragraph to the platform of the Republican Party's platform at the Republican National Convention in July. It read, "We salute the people of Taiwan with whom we share the values of democracy, human rights, a free market economy, and the rule of law. China's behavior has negated the optimistic language of our last platform concerning our future relations with China." Now, that's official policy of the Republican Party, which doesn't necessarily mean anything because, of course, in American politics, the programs don't mean anything. But in our last 30 seconds, John Pilger, you see this playing out in a long-term way, that, in other words, this growing confrontational stance between the United States and China, not necessarily an imminent clash.
I don't know. I'm not a futurist. But what I do know is that people have got to wake up. They've just had a U.S. presidential election in which none of these issues of war and peace were debated, either the war that almost seems to be about to happen on the western borders of Russia, or this extraordinary build-up in the Asia-Pacific. And we've got to become aware of this. There has to be a movement of concerned people that frankly stops collectively wringing their hands and taking on these issues. Great movements in the United States have done that, and with great success. That's got to happen again.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. Wise words from filmmaker John Pilger. He has made 60 movies. His latest film, just out, is The Coming War on China. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. We are going to talk about Syria and the liberation of Aleppo, perhaps just days, perhaps hours away. We are joined from Stuttgart, Germany, by Syrian journalist Kavork Almasian. Welcome back, Kavork.
Thank you, sir.
Kavork, let's start with what the situation is like now on the ground in Aleppo. Reports from yesterday morning said that perhaps up to 85% of eastern Aleppo that had been rebel-held since 2012 has been retaken by the Syrian army.
Exactly. Actually, we can't tell the real percentage of the control over Aleppo because it's changing every single minute. So while it was yesterday 85%, today would be 90%, 95%. So the advancement of the Syrian army is very fast, and they are rapidly grabbing the territories held by the militants who were in control of these areas starting from June 2012 until this moment. However, there are other developments that we have to take into consideration is that there is consent now among the fighting groups, the anti-government groups in eastern neighborhoods of Aleppo, and the consensus that they ask their representatives in Turkey to negotiate with Russia and with the Syrian government for evacuation plan. The evacuation plan, now there is a discussion over it because the Syrian government prefers that these people lay down their arms and a reconciliation program would be applied on them so they can continue their lives the way they were before carrying the arms. This is for the Syrian nationals who hold the arms. As for the foreigners, there is no way that the Syrian government would accept the evacuation and by sending them into other places. However, on the militant side, the representatives of these groups are pushing hard to evacuate them into Idlib. That means that they want to take hundreds of militants into Idlib, maybe to launch another offensive from South Aleppo. However, in my own estimation, I believe that there is no way possible from now on that these militants to break the siege on Aleppo again or to regain any territories within inside the city. Because when the army liberates the whole eastern neighborhoods of Aleppo, the military operations will not stop. not a single day. The expectations is that the Syrian army will try to move forward in north and south of Aleppo, in north to reach al-Bab and then to the Turkish borders in order to zip it in front of the support that comes from Turkey. But this is also a little bit dangerous step because we all know that the Turkish troops are now 30 kilometers north of Aleppo city. So there is a possibility that there might be a direct confrontation between Turkey and the Syrian army. That's why the diplomatic pressure of Moscow is highly needed in this particular of time. The second step is into south of Aleppo, moving towards southwest to Idlib. But this also requires that the Syrian troops in North Latakia to move forward into the south of Idlib, so in order to sandwich them from both sides. I think the main battle nowadays is in two places. One is Idlib and the second is Raqqa. In my opinion, the priority for the Syrian army is Al-Qaeda, Al-Nusra Front, in Idlib, because some states and governments in the West and also in the Gulf, they are hesitant to declare Al-Nusra Front as a terrorist organization, and they are supplying them with arms and ammunition. So by destroying these terror organizations, the Western government, at least the Western governments, will not dare to support ISIS in Iraq. So if, in my opinion, the Syrian army liberates Idlib after Aleppo, we can say that the insurgent against the Syrian army, against the Syrian state, is over, because Raqqa is a matter of international, it's an international issue more than only a Syrian issue. And I think the Americans, especially when the president-elect Donald Trump comes to power, he will deal harshly with ISIS alongside in cooperation with Russia as well.
Well, let's talk about Russia's role diplomatically then with Turkey, because, as you said, that could be of prime importance, especially if Syrian Arab army forces in the north of Aleppo are now coming into contact with and possibly clashing with Turkish forces. On December 8th, Vladimir Putin signed an agreement with Erdogan for the Turkish Stream Agreement. Putin said in a meeting with Prime Minister Yildirim on Tuesday, the Turkish Prime Minister, that Russia is grateful to President Erdogan for the Turkish Stream Agreement. "We are grateful to President Erdogan for signing the Turkish Stream Agreement," said Putin. Talk about Turkish-Russian relations. They've been up and down, obviously. They went through a period of extreme hostility. Now there's obviously a thaw. Russia is backing the Syrian government. It's backing the existence of the Syrian state and the Assad government, and says the Syrian Arab army is indispensable to the elimination of terrorists in Syria. What will Russia do thus in relationship to Turkey on this front?
I think the relationship between Russia and Turkey at this, especially at this particular point, is very important and crucial to solve the a lot of solved issues in the Middle East, and especially in North Syria and also North Iraq. The Russians nowadays have leverage over Erdogan. Just remember that Erdogan, last week, he said that our mission in Syria is to overthrow Bashar Assad. And the second day, when there was a phone call between President Putin and President Erdogan, the spokesman of the Turkish presidency said that Erdogan didn't mean to overthrow Assad, and we shouldn't take his statements literally in the way he said. So Russia nowadays is able to put maximum pressure on Erdogan and to guarantee his interest in the area. Nowadays, Turkey is suffering from huge economic problems, and Russia is able to empower again, to re-stabilize the Turkish economy through the gas agreements on one hand, and on the second hand is to allow for Turkey, after taking the consent of the Syrian government, to participate in the reconstruction of Syria. That also means that the revival of the Turkish economy. So it's a win-win situation nowadays. The only thing that Erdogan needs to understand that his ideological and imperial aspirations is over. He can't move towards Syria to capture Aleppo, to capture Mosul. These dreams are over, he cannot simply bet again on arming and funding other militant groups. In Syria, Turkey betted on ISIS, on al-Nusra Front, on Ahrar al-Sham, on Islam's army, on the Free Syrian Army, on Islamic Turkestan Party, on many different groups. Even if some of these groups are hostile to each other, but Erdogan tried to manage these different groups in order to achieve his strategic goal. All these failed in the last 5 years, in the last 6 years, and it's impossible today to regain momentum in Syria, and it's impossible to have an upper hand again in Aleppo. The storm, the northern storm, as General Suhail Hassan declared in north of Syria, it will continue until the liberation of the entire Aleppo with its suburbs, north and south suburbs, until we reach the borders and zip it in front of the foreign mercenaries and the funding and support that comes from Turkey.
We're speaking with Kaybark Almasyan. He is a Syrian journalist now living in Germany. We're talking about the liberation of Aleppo. A few days ago, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said that Washington withdrew its own proposals on resolving the Aleppo issue. He explained that American diplomats refused to meet on December 7th to discuss the situation in the embattled Syrian city, although 5 days earlier, U.S. Secretary of State Kerry handed over a proposal, which Russia said it supported. And then I'm reading now in an article from Sputnik, our website, Washington is currently working on a new document. The draft, according to Russia's top diplomat, appears meant to give the militants some time to recover and replenish their supplies. Lavrov, the foreign minister of Russia, described the situation as, quote, nothing short of a detective story. Can you talk about that?
In my opinion, the Americans are wasting their time. It's the last day of the last days of this administration, and they are not able to revive their strategy in Syria. It's all now in the hands of the president-elect Trump. John Kerry is trying to polish the image of the American administration by saying that we tried our best and we supported the so-called revolutionaries because in the West, these people will bring democracy and human rights to Syria, so we didn't abandon them until the last day, which is untrue. They are even lying on their own people. The militants, their proxies fighting in Syria are mostly Islamists, and they don't even believe in democracy. Imagine that in moderate rebel-held areas in Idlib, as the Americans like to call them, it's written on the walls and the streets everywhere that democracy is some kind of apostasy or it's against God. So in order to give the impression in front of their own people, Kerry is trying to promote this narrative that we will give another project maybe to save our guys in Syria, those who are fighting the quote-unquote brutal dictator Bashar Assad. But I mean, this is only media consumption nowadays, and nobody believes that the Americans are capable of doing anything serious in Aleppo. Even their allies, namely Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, they're no more. They're always interested to overthrow President Bashar Assad, but their calculations were all wrong. And nowadays things are changing. It's not 2001. It's not 2012. And not even 2013. The table has turned upside down, and the maximum thing that the foes of Syria can reach in Syria is to deal with President Bashar Assad and guarantee their future interest in this particular geographical point. Otherwise, if they continue in their policy, I don't think the region no more coexistence between Assad and Erdogan or Hamad or Tamim and al-Saud is not possible anymore in the same area.
Kaybark, we have about 2.5 minutes. I want to ask you two quick things. One is, if the non-Syrian Islamicist fighters in Aleppo are not allowed to surrender, I'm not allowed to be part of a repatriation plan whereby they are able to come back into normal life, as the Syrian rebels are being offered right now by the Syrian government, they must then fight because they're not going to be allowed to evacuate. So there would be, would seem to me, a fight to the finish then. Tell me if I'm wrong there in East Aleppo with them. Secondarily, if they're cleared from East Aleppo, as seems to be imminent, and then cleared from Idlib, you said then that the situation is turned decisively because of the nature of the forces in Raqqa. When you look down the road, we have about a minute and a half, where do you see Syria in a year and a half, 2 years, 3 years? In other words, is it the same Syria? Is it federalized? How do you see it playing out?
First of all, for the foreign fighters in eastern Aleppo, I think they cannot confront the continued fighting the Syrian army when the thousands of their colleagues, the Syrian fighters, surrender or abandon fighting the Syrian army. They have two choices, either to die or to surrender to the Syrian army. If they surrender to the Syrian army, I think the government is able to negotiate with for bargains with their own countries, because some of them are British, others are Americans, Chechenians, and many other nationalities. The second thing, today I was asked the same question from some of my colleagues, that what would happen within 1.5 years, 2 years. I said the estimates are after Aleppo and Idlib maybe 6 more months, and then we have a decisive 1 year to finish the some packets in the desert, especially in Raqqa, moving to the south in the desert of Homs and into the resort. This needs, in my opinion, 2 years after Idlib, and the peace and the stability will be restored in into Syria, because most this liberal and leftist think tank analysts were saying it's impossible for Assad to regain control over this and that, and all the realities underground and the experience proved that whenever and wherever the Syrian army decided to liberate, they were able to do it, starting from the suburbs of Damascus, moving to Homs, to Hama, now in Aleppo. So when the turn comes to Idlib and into Raqqa and their resort, they will be liberated. It's only a matter of time.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. We've been talking to Kaibor Kalmasian. He's a Syrian journalist, originally from Aleppo. We're talking to him from Stuttgart, Germany. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. We're in Havana, Cuba. We've been here for several days. We're talking to Cuban people and international friends of Cuba who have visited. This, of course, is the days of mourning for the historic leader of the Cuban Revolution, Fidel Castro, whose remains were interred in Santiago over the weekend. We're speaking with Janela Gonzalez. She is with ECAP, the Cuban Institute for Friendship and Solidarity with People Around the World. Janela, you have a particular focus, a specialist on the United States. And of course, in the U.S. mainstream media, there's a lot of talk about what will Cuba be like? What will U.S.-Cuban relations be like after the passing of Fidel? And while Fidel was, of course, the historic leader of the Cuban Revolution, he has not been, in fact, the head of state for almost a decade, since he has been in ill health. So in many ways, a transition has already begun. What I'd like to start this interview by talking about is how you, as a Cuban woman, as a person, as a human being, how you have felt in the last 2 weeks about what Cuba, what Fidel meant to Cuba, what his passing means.
We say in every part, after Fidel passed away, we say, I am Fidel. That means that Fidel is in our heart, because Fidel make for the possible dreams from the Cuban people, that they believe that the socialism system, that they believe that the education and the health, they have to be for everybody. So as a woman girl here in Cuba, I feel really sad, because we lost a leader, we lost a friend, we lost a brother, we lost our father. So for us, it's really interesting that the people, they come to Cuba to know and to see with their own eyes what happening in Cuba. What is the answer for the people of Cuba? Because that means that Fidel, that is in the heart for all the Cubans. So we are really sad, but at the same time, it's like a courage, it's like the next step to continue his legacy. to continue to defend our history, to continue to defend all the friendship that we have in the whole world. So that's the main thing for us, to continue to be this system, this country, a better every day. So now is our time to answer all the legacy that Fidel say to us. Now is our time to continue the dreams to hold the Cuban, even that they don't know. You can see in the street the little children, the young people, to talking about Fidel. So we have to prepare this the new generation, because the revolution we can lose.
You know, I came to Cuba for the first time in, I think, 1994, 1995, a very difficult period. The Soviet Union had just collapsed. Cuba lost 80% of its foreign trade. It was a very difficult time. There were electrical blackouts. There were shortages, food shortages. Much of the industry couldn't run because of the absence of energy. It was a tough time. It was the special period, as the Cubans call it. But today, in 2016, at the time that Fidel Castro has died, there's so much activity, so much economic activity, so much vibrancy in the country. Talk about the way the Cuban government has helped stabilize the economic situation after such a big blow as the loss of the Soviet Union.
We have to increase ourselves in every part of the economic and every part of the thing that we have to make together. Because we lost a lot of things in that time. I was 14 years old, and I remember that time. It was a really hard time, but we are a resistant culture. So for us, the time is to resist. In that time, the blockade, in that time, the Soviet Union disappeared. So that in that time, our legacy was we need to resist. And the main thing, it has to be unit. So if you are not unit in our country, we cannot have the thing that we are now. We are to increase economical in the tourism, in the medical service, to fund a different ways to support our government, in biotechnology, in the sport, in area. So we have to increase ourselves. We have to invest in different countries. But the main thing is that we always support the government, always support the idea that education and the health has to be to everybody. So they the main reason that even the economical development that we have to do that, we support the idea that education and health, they have to be to everybody. So every person here in Cuba, they have the opportunity to have the dreams. They have access to go to the university. They have access to have a normal life as a Cuban person. But it's not something that the people they can hand up. We never give up. But the main thing that they affect to us is the blockade. After 2 years, the things changed here in Cuba. We reestablished the government, you know, the relationship between both countries. But now we don't know what's going to happen. But in our case, we are continuing with the hope that Cuba and United States, they have the normal relationship. But we can do that because the blockade exists and they affect to us. So we have to continue increase every day. We have to defend our ideas, and we have to tell to everybody that the blockade affect to us and the impact in all these areas and the social areas that we defend.
I want to come back to you in a few minutes about U.S.-Cuban relations. Now that President Barack Obama is leaving office, Donald Trump is coming into office, and what that might portend for U.S.-Cuba relations. Of course, the United States and Cuba did not have diplomatic relations, did not have embassies in Washington or Havana for 54 years. The blockade is a form of economic warfare, an insidious form of economic warfare. It tries to use food and medicine and money as a weapon against civilians. I want to talk to you about that, but before we do that, I want to ask you just as a person. You said you were 14 at the time of the collapse of the Soviet Union. That means you were born well after Fidel came to power on January 1st, 1959. How did the revolution impact your family? Because it was your parents' generation, really, that was the current generation at the time of 1959, or maybe your grandparents even. How did it impact on them, and then how did it impact on you as a family?
Before that, 1959, before than that, the black people, they don't have right here in Cuba. So I'm a black woman, and my family, my grandpas, that they are alive, they are still alive here in Cuba. The revolution impact for the better situation with the black people here in Cuba. In my case, the legacy of Fidel Castro, my grandpa, he fight in the Bay of Pigs. He's a revolutionary man. And my father, he participated in Angola war in the 70th year.
Your father did.
My father. And now he is in Angola to teach. Even in every family here in Cuba, there is a history about the impact and the make difference in the generation after revolution time. Now we are right. Now we have the possibility to increase ourselves, to study, to support and other stuff. So in my case, as a black woman, I don't have to pay to go to university. I don't have to be like in another bus, in another place for black people. No. Here in Cuba, we don't talking about black and white people. We're working about the Cubans people. So to have the same right for everybody here in Cuba after the revolution time, of course, they impact in my family as a better way.
And Fidel made the point that Cuba was an Afro-Cuban culture. In other words, he made a point of the rich contributions Africa, black Africa, made in all ways to the evolution and development of Cuban society. And that was also a way of elevating the centrality for black Cubans of their own history, where during the period of enslavement, which was perhaps the last country in the Western Hemisphere to ban slavery, I believe, you correct me if I'm wrong, and then all of the decades and decades of severe racism and discrimination against the black population, I mean, that really has been a centerpiece of this revolution.
Yes, the point of the Afro-Cuban history here in Cuba is really huge because the resistant culture that for the Cuban, that from Africa, the slaves here in Africa. And when we're talking about Cuban culture, that a mix, as you say, that from Spanish, from Italian, from people from Africa, for the whole world, that they make possible that the Cuban culture and the Cuban system and the Cuban situation like a resistant. So it's like a priority. That was the priority from Fidel Castro when the Trump of the revolution, that everybody has to be equal. Everybody has the same opportunity. Everybody has the same chance to have a better life. Of course, some people, and I have to tell you that, some people say that in Cuba, they exist racism here in Cuba, discrimination of that. I'm going to tell you something. As an institution, as a government, we don't have any discriminate racial here in Cuba with the people. Isn't maybe in the family, maybe in the tradition, but Cuba always defend the idea that we don't have difference between black and white people. That's what I'm telling you. We don't say like black and white. No, we say Cubans. Everybody's Cubans. Of course, we have to improve ourselves to study and to be the same opportunity and the same possibility to everybody, to the black and white people, because we are colony from Spain for 500 years, and a revolution is more than 50 years. So in the mind of the people, some of the people, maybe they can say that. But it's not an institution, it's not a government. So I have the same opportunity as the white, as the yellow, and the blue people. Everybody's equal here in Cuba. Everybody has the same opportunity. So you have to study, you have to increase yourself, and the government give you the opportunity to that.
We're talking to Janela Gonzalez. We're talking about the passing of Fidel Castro, how the Cuban people are feeling, what they're thinking. We've been talking to Cubans, Janela, from all walks of life for the past few days about this historic moment, the loss of the historic leader of the Cuban Revolution and its impact. You are paying careful attention to what's going on in the United States, to what people's movements and social justice movements are doing inside the United States. And we've been talking about racism and the primacy that Fidel attached to the fight against racism, to stop racism. it was remarkable that when his delegation first came to the United States,
yes,
after the Cuban Revolution, they stayed first at an affluent hotel in Park Avenue, but he picked up and they took everyone to the Hotel Teresa in Harlem. And no governmental leader had ever come to Harlem, the center of Black America. And of course, we all know that, like in Cuba, racism and discrimination were such a prominent part of the United States. 15,000 people from Harlem, yes, came out day after day. They stayed in the streets because they were so excited. And Cuba made a huge impact on the Black civil rights movement in America, on the Black liberation movement. And it still does. As you look at the United States, you can see that right now people in the United States are experiencing, as we have for a long time, an epidemic of police violence directed against Black people and against Latinos in the United States. And there is a new movement called the Movement for Black Lives, or the Black Lives Matter movement.
Yes.
Do the Cuban people know about that? Does the Cuban government know about it? How do you feel?
We feel very bad because that situation in the United States. Even in my case, I follow the news about what happened with the Afro-American movement in the United States. And here in Cuba, we are really sad about that. We don't think that what happened here in the United States in the 21st century, that happened in the United States. For me, it's really sad to see that to see this kind of extent about the police brutality, about the violence. Of course, we defend the human rights, and that means that we defend the things that are good for the Black people around the world. What that happened in the United States is really concern, not only from Cuba, for the whole world concerned about what happened in the United States. And the time that you speak about Fidel and Hotel Teresa and the whole Black movement, and in that time Fidel Castro had the opportunity to see Malcolm X. So for us, I think that time means that the solidarity movement around the world, they putting the eyes on Cuba. So with the action in the Harlem neighbors, the people around to Fidel to protect him, the delegation to protect Cuba, that means that the solidarity movement, after that, they start to interest about what happened here in Cuba. So when we receive group from United States, I always say something. People from Cuba and people from United States, they all will be together. Even that they don't have a relationship before than that, we always, the people, not the government, because you know the history, but the people from United States, they always have with Cuba and Cuba with them.
We're speaking with Janella Gonzalez about Cuba during the transition following the death of Fidel Castro and what's coming next. And we're emphasizing really the impact that Fidel made on the struggle for equality and the struggle against discrimination and the struggle against racism and how that impacts, of course, Black Cubans, but also people in the United States and especially the African-American community. It also had a great impact on Africa. And these are all interconnected issues. Janella, you said your father fought in Angola as a volunteer. That would have been in 1976 or 77, 78, during those years where the Cuban government, in alliance with the MPLA, the new liberation government in Angola, fought against the most powerful racist army in the world, the South African army, and defeated that army. And as a consequence of the defeat there that the South African army experienced, that began the process of the end of apartheid, mm-hmm, and ultimately led to the freedom of Nelson Mandela and all of the other freedom fighters in South Africa. And Nelson Mandela, when he got out of prison, he wanted to meet with Fidel first and foremost, because when Africa called, Cuba, under the leadership of Fidel, answered.
When we made about Africa, we say Cuba. Because Africa for us is everything, you know, even because they are the first country that they asking for the support of the solidarity idea and the position. And in that time, Cuba, they showed to the whole world at the solidarity movement of the military, of course, position that we can help the person that they need our help. So that's some of the example of the internationalism feelings that we have here in Cuba, That means that Africa, when they call them, we are there, we answer. And that means that every family here in Cuba, almost one person in every family here in Cuba, they been in Africa, not only by the fighters in that time. They've been in Africa to help as a medical, as a doctors, of course, as a professors, as the civil engineer that my father, because he was in the fight time, but he was a civil engineer to help to make bridges and other stuff in the construction. So Africa for us is everything. So when you can see now the whole president from Latin America and from Africa, that they come so far away to be here with us, that means that Fidel Castro doing everything for Africa.
Your father was a fighter. Was he a volunteer? The Cubans said all the fighters who went to help Angola to defeat South Africa, they were volunteers.
He was volunteers, yes.
And how old was he when he went?
30 years, almost. 30 years. I don't be born that time, only my old sister. So he left my old sister and he going to Africa. And now he come back 30 years after that time to teach in the university in Luanda, Angola. So that's the history.
Amazing story. We're talking with Yanela Gonzalez. She's with ECAP. She is a black Cuban who has, like so many millions of people, benefited from the Cuban Revolution and is now herself an envoy, a diplomatic person, and reaching out to other people, people to people, on behalf of ECAP. Yanela Gonzalez, thank you so much. Well, that's all the time we have. We will be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.